Welcome to the Grace and Grit Podcast, made for women who want their healthiest years to be ahead of them, not behind them. Join me, Courtney Townley, right now as I break down the fairy tale health story you have been chasing all of your life into sensible action steps and lasting change. Hello, and thank you so much for joining me today on the Grace and Grit Podcast. This is Courtney Townley, your host for the show. And for those of you who've been listening to the podcast for a while now, know that movement has been a very big part of my life. I've always had a really deep curiosity and passion for movement because to me, it's kind of like food. There's just so many different flavors and possibilities to explore. And let's face it, movement is a very big conversation. There are a lot of components to movement and an endless array of methods and schools of thought about how to best improve the capacity for movement in the human body. I mean, you don't have to look very far to find all kinds of methods and techniques and studios and gyms, right? And today's guest is one of my nearest and dearest friends. Eve Bernfeld and I have witnessed and cheered on each other's movement journeys since we were about 10 years old. And I could spend the next hour bragging about all of the reasons I adore this woman. But in summary, she's crazy smart, driven, and really deeply passionate about her work. And that's really what I brought her here to share with you today is her work. Eve is a certified Alexander Technique teacher, and Alexander Technique, I know, may be a really new method for some of you. Some of you may have never heard of that before. And I'm going to get into, obviously, what it is as I interview her. But Eve spent a tremendous amount of time getting qualified to teach this method, over 3 years of her life and over 1,600 hours of training. She was trained at the Oregon Center for Alexander Technique in Portland, and even went on to London to study at a school there to get qualified to teach the Alexander Technique for the childbearing year. Her teaching is really heavily influenced by her theater background. Eve has a master's in theater education from Emerson College and a bachelor's in theater performance and philosophy from Fordham University in New York City. So Eve, I'm so glad you're here with me. Thanks for making the time.
I'm so happy to be here with you, Courtney. It's very exciting.
I know. It's crazy, like the road we've traveled together, and now I'm interviewing you on a podcast.
Yeah, it's been sort of date ourselves. I was thinking we've been friends for almost 30 years.
Isn't that wild? I love that though. I love it. Those are the best friendships, truly. And you've been such a gift in my life. And I didn't say this in your intro, but You do have triplets, and I know that that is a mighty large portion of your life at this point.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's a big part of my sort of daily load. It's two and a half year old triplets.
Yeah. Wow. Yes. I have one, and I just have such admiration for you because I can't even fathom three, as most listeners probably can't. So tell us a little bit what you're up to these days. Just obviously taking care of little ones for sure.
Yes. That's a big part of it. And we do all kinds of fun and exciting things, splashing in puddles here in Portland. And I also have my own business in Balance, Alexander Technique, where I teach all kinds of people how to improve how they use themselves. And I'm an adjunct professor at Lewis and Clark College. And I also teach Alexander Technique there. So it's a pretty busy plate, that and raising some chickens and, you know, the Northwest lifestyle thing.
Yeah, lots of outdoor activities, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I would say just chickens and raising triplets would be a heavy load in and of itself. But then to have your own business, you know, and be teaching, as I know you do a lot, is just crazy admirable. I'm so proud of you. So to tell people a little bit about what led you to become a teacher of the Alexander Technique.
Yeah, it's sort of a silly and convoluted story, but I first encountered the Alexander Technique when I was 15 years old. I was at Interlochen Arts Camp, and I heard about a workshop, and it was had all these cool words like freedom and ease and poise attached to it. So I thought that sounded really good, and I signed up, and then I came down with chicken pox, and I was in quarantine for that workshop itself. I missed it.
Poor Eve. Yeah.
So it stuck there. You know, I had a friend who went and she came back and she said, oh, I felt so light and I felt so free. And I was like, I want that. As I think you can probably attest, being a teenage dancer does not necessarily make one feel light or free. It's more like tired and in pain and blistered, you know?
Yeah.
So that stuck in my head, but it took me a very long time to actually get to it because it was always either, you know, I went to college in New York and I lived there for a while after that and I had no time and no money, lots of teachers, but I wasn't in a place to do it. And then I moved back to Wyoming and I had some time, but no teachers. And then I moved to Boston for my master's degree. And again, no time, no money. Moved to Wyoming and no teachers. So then I made a crazy move and I quit my good job as the education director of a small theater company. And I moved to Chicago with my boyfriend and my cat to study improv, which is sort of the kind of thing you do when you're like 22 years old, you know? I was 30 and I was really looking for what's next in my life because I was burned out. And I didn't imagine that improv was the thing. It was just something interesting to do. And I was also, you talk about movement, I really missed having movement be a big part of my life because I injured myself at 17 and basically stopped dancing. Mm-hmm. So that was a huge shift. And, you know, when you're doing something like dance, your brain is so intricate in the way that it maps the rest of your body. I mean, it's like a pianist who, there's so much, so many details in the brain mapping the pianist's hands, so much more than the rest of us mortal people who just use our hands for whatever we do. And the same with the dancer. And so when you stop moving like that, those maps in your brain, that sort of internal representation gets kind of murky and I missed it so much. I tried some Aikido, I took some dance classes, I read some books about some different movement methods. And then I was in Chicago and I got this check in the mail. It was a gift from my aunt and I was like, oh, I have time and now I have money. So I'm going to finally do this Alexander technique thing 15 years later.
Yeah.
After I'd first encountered it. And I found a teacher who I really lucked out. And the teacher that I found was wonderful. He'd been teaching for 30 years, a man named John Hennis. And I went to my first lesson, of course, with these really absurdly high expectations. And it was better. It was better than what I had hoped for. So after about three lessons, I said, you know, how do I do what you do? And he explained, well, you have to find a training course and train for 3 years and all that stuff that you said in your intro. So I did. We got married. We moved to Portland and I trained.
Awesome. So, I love it. So tell us in really simple terms, what exactly is the Alexander technique? Because I know a lot of people are going to be wondering that.
Yeah. I love the opportunity to tell people that because Alexander technique's been around for 120 years, but a lot of people in the United States have never heard of it. It is a method of self-care. It is an educational method that helps us unravel the ways that we are interfering with natural functioning, natural movement, the way that we should be operating, but aren't. Because over the course of our lives, we've accumulated a whole lot of habits of excessive tension and misdirected effort and just basically trying too hard to do everything. For the flip side, basically collapsing all the time, all of that behavior is habitual. So the Alexander technique helps people figure out how to not do the stuff that's getting in their own way. I like to think of it as most things, when we want to improve a skill or when we want to get over a pain, we use a process of addition. You know, like, okay, I want to be a better singer, so I'm going to practice more and I'm going to sing all the time and I'm going to find another teacher and I'm going to just, it's this constant adding on to ourselves. Alexander technique is the opposite. It's a mm-hmm. process of subtraction. Mm-hmm. What am I already doing that I am not aware of because I do it all the time that is getting in my way?
Mm-hmm. Which is so interesting because I think so many things that ultimately lead to health are honestly about subtraction.
Yes.
Especially in today's world.
It seems to be a theme in your podcast, which I love. It's like, yes, yes, yes. That's what
we're remove, reduce, right? Recover.
Want more education and inspiration to help you reclaim your health and happiness? Visit graceandgrit.com and register your email to have all kinds of goods delivered straight to your inbox.
Tell listeners, in what ways have you actually seen Alexander Technique improve the lives of your students? What are some specific examples?
Well, people often come to me because they're experiencing pain. There's actually a pretty interesting and growing body of research about the Alexander Technique being incredibly helpful for pain conditions, which is interesting because Alexander Technique is not a therapy. It's an educational method. But what we've found is that learning how to not abuse yourself moment to moment actually improves how we function, which is logical.
You know, of course, yes. Go figure.
So there's a lot of great research about back pain, neck pain. A recent study showed that it helped with knee pain associated with osteoarthritis. So people often come because something hurts. Or they're a performer and they've heard that it will help them improve their performance, because that's where most people who know of the work have heard about it in a performing arts context. It's often a part of conservatory programs for musicians and actors and dancers. Mm-hmm. Who have to perform at their peak and are also very prone to injury because they are working so hard. So what I love is that they come for a specific thing, and often we unwind and unravel that specific thing, and often they feel much better. But they often notice that things totally unrelated, at least what they perceive to be totally unrelated to that issue, get better. I had a student who was about 7 months pregnant and in terrible back pain. She walked in to my studio and she was like hunched over. She looked like an old woman. And we worked for quite a while. And then one day she just sort of mentions in passing, "Oh yeah, my back hasn't hurt for a really long time." Like, "Oh, thanks for letting me know." But she also said that she had like so much more confidence at work, and she was able to portray herself in a much more self-assured manner. She was able to strip all these kind of apologetic body language things that she wasn't even aware that she'd had. And it was all part of the process. Mm-hmm. So I love it when people start to notice things that weren't the reason that they came. They start to notice they can deal with stress better. They start to notice that they have skills to manage themselves, mm-hmm. and they don't necessarily need to be rescued like they had before. Like, "Oh my God, I need a massage." Mm-hmm. Like, or maybe I don't. Maybe I can manage myself. And massage is just for fun.
Yeah, I love that. And just hearing you talk is sort of, you know, very much emulating. I don't know if you listened to the episodes a few back with Irene Lyon, right? The Feldenkrais and somatic experience.
Great
practitioner. And so, and I know you had said to me in passing that there is some correlation between Alexander and Feldenkrais. And what is that exactly?
Well, Feldenkrais, Moshe Feldenkrais took many Alexander lessons prior to creating his method. So I am not an expert in Feldenkrais.
Sure, of course.
I couldn't say how much of his Alexander experience trickled into his own method, which is quite different. Mm-hmm. But I think some of the premises are similar, and often the work is quite compatible, the two bodies of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and hearing you describe it, it definitely sounds a little bit similar in the sense that, yes, your clients are coming in for a specific pain or condition, but really your work is probably tapping into a much deeper system, like the nervous system, which is, you know, helping them to resolve so many other issues that maybe they weren't even aware of.
Yep.
Obviously, you're someone who works with a lot of clients, a lot of students. And what are some of the most common tensions that you see with people? Obviously, everyone has individual conditions, but there's got to be some common threads with the type of tension that you see.
Yes, there absolutely is. And I know that your listeners can't see me, but I'm going to show you.
Okay. Yeah. Shoulders to the ears, right?
Yep. Shoulders to the ears.
Yeah.
The chin thrust forward, a whole lot of stiffening and excess tension through the neck. Mm-hmm. So that whole part of you from basically the collarbone up through the head, that is very commonly out of whack. Mm-hmm. Alexander noticed this first in himself. The Alexander Technique, I should mention, was created by a man named Frederick Matthias Alexander, or FM, everyone called him. And he created it out of necessity because he was losing his voice. He was an actor who was losing his voice. So he had to figure out, what am I doing to myself that's causing me to lose my voice? Which is a pretty profound question, because most of us, when we have a problem, we want someone to fix us. And of course, he did too, but nobody could help him. So he had to learn to unravel. I think I used that word before, but I like it. Unravel his own problems. And what he noticed was that he was interfering with the poise of his head relative to his trunk. And then he noticed, oh, wow, everyone else seems to be doing that too. And that's still the case today. So the most common thing that I see is this interference with a coordinated head, neck, and trunk relationship. We call it the primary control because it is primary in our overall coordination. So if you're doing that thing that raising the shoulders and thrusting the chin forward, and you can hear it in my voice, it's like, it's not good, then generally the rest of you is not going to have the potential to function very well. If you can get out of your own way and stop doing those things, then you have the potential for the rest of you to function much better. Mm-hmm. So while we do look at your legs and your feet and your hands and your arms and all that stuff, and of course the way you're thinking is very crucial to my work, we always start with the head, neck, trunk relationship.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit more about that as far as the thinking piece. How do you work with someone with their, I'm assuming, mindset sort of patterning in a session? I mean, what does that look like?
Well, we start with stopping.
That's great.
Because what Alexander noticed about himself and then others was that our automatic patterns are so strong that there is no chance of changing behavior if you don't first stop. Mm. And that's not the way most people try to change behavior. Everyone just tries to do something else and do some exercises and do some stretches and go get some kind of a therapeutic, which all these therapies can be incredibly helpful for acute situations. I don't mean to denigrate them at all. But none of them address the problem of habit or automaticity, that a stimulus and a response, their automatic response, are coupled for us. So if every time I do something, I automatically interfere with that head, neck, trunk relationship, I tense up, then there's no other way, there's nothing's going to help me until I can learn to stop doing that. So I have to start with stopping. And we practice what Alexander called conscious stopping or conscious inhibition. Inhibition meaning just to stop. None of that Freudian repression crap, just stopping. That's where we start with the kind of self-talk that we do. And then once we get actually sort of schooled at stopping ourselves, then we can add some other self-talk that helps us to achieve what we would prefer instead of the old behaviors. So I can give you some examples. I think you probably are going to ask me later for some things that people might do. And I have some examples of that, a sort of simplified version of that self-talk.
Okay, excellent. Yeah.
That we ask people to engage in, because this work is, I had a student once who described it as mental yoga. People come in thinking it's going to be like moving around, and of course there is movement, but it's very much thinking based. It's a thinking person's method.
Mm-hmm. I like that, a thinking person's method, and very much an awareness method. Yes. I mean,
absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Awareness is crucial to change.
Which most people don't want to do because it takes time. It takes time and energy, but it really is the only way to lasting change. I believe that. I know you believe that.
Yeah. Thing about time too, because I agree. Everyone thinks I don't have time to stop. I mean, I hear that. I hear that constantly. And the funny thing about that is it doesn't take a lot of time to stop. I mean, yes, you could set aside a whole hour and do nothing, but it takes about 3 seconds, maybe 2 seconds. And unless your child is running into the street, you probably have 2 seconds to stop and then become aware of what you're actually doing.
Not to mention, I think a lot of people, you know, say that I don't have the time or I don't have, you know, the energy. And yet they also don't have the time and energy to suffer the pain they're suffering.
Yes.
And that's, you know, they're investing a tremendous amount of time, money, and energy into something that isn't working for them. And so they do technically have the time.
Yep. It's so hard. I mean, I know this from my own experience, of course, especially, you know, having babies. And as you know, like having a baby, sleep becomes an issue. And you keep doing things that don't work just because you're too tired to try to come up with something that works better. So I get it. I absolutely get where people are coming from. It seems insurmountable to make a change. But that's why we ask people to start really small. Just pause. Just pause for a second.
You mentioned the neck tension and sort of the shoulder tension. And what, why do you think that is? I mean, you know, I know with a lot of methods, you know, we talk about just because everything in front is so in front of us all the time, you know, the computer screen, the driving. And of course, now we have this whole world of texting and being on cell phones. I mean, are there some other things that you think play into that, that habit building around the neck and shoulders?
I think there are actually. And Alexander, having noticed this before we had almost any of those things except for cars, he had a theory. He called it an unduly excited fear response. Because we all know about the fight or flight response, and we all know that we're stuck in it too often. That's a pretty common theme these days, that we, you know, we have too much cortisol and adrenaline going through us all the time. But what most people don't know is there's a distinct motor pattern associated with the fight or flight or the startle response. And it involves everything I just described: tightening the neck, retracting the head down onto the spine, and lifting the sort of the hackles or the shoulders. And you can imagine a cat that has been startled. The hair raises on the back of its neck. It's ready to pounce or to flee. And that's that stereotyped motor pattern, which, and I know you spoke about this in that same episode with the Feldenkrais teacher, that we tend to get stuck in a startle response, a low-level fight or flight response all the time. Unlike the cat, we don't let it go. The cat, 2 seconds later, is fine and is taking a nap in the sun, or the, you know, the antelope that are being chased by the lion. You look at them soon after and they're totally back to a normal resting state, but we get stuck. So it's no wonder that when you go around in this sort of modified, you know, slight fear response all the time, it's no wonder you have neck pain. It's no wonder your back hurts because you're compressing the spine all the time. But it's also no wonder that you feel stressed all of the time.
Yeah. And you have digestive issues and you can't sleep at night. And it just, yeah, it just perpetuates so many problems.
Yes. So that is Alexander's theory about why we have this interference with natural functioning. And he believed that we were really, it's kind of funny to say now, is in the 1890s, he believed that we were overstimulated by the pace of modern life.
He'd be horrified now.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
But we have a beautiful, wonderful brain that has the capacity to use our conscious thinking to stop that.
Yes. It's so true. And just neuroplasticity is such a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I think, obviously, I mean, we're hearing a lot more about it now. It's sort of getting into to mainstream, I think, education and media, but it's the beauty of being able to change at any point in our life, regardless of our past. And yeah, that definitely gives us hope, right?
Yes. Yes.
Inspired by the Grace and Grit podcast, but still feeling like you're having a tough time digging your heels in to improving your health story? Go to graceandgrit.com and click contact at the bottom of the screen to book a free 20-minute consultation with Courtney. So give us a general idea of what an Alexander Technique class would look like. Like, what is a typical class look like?
Yes. Well, typically, I actually do teach some group classes. I teach that class at Lewis and Clark College. I teach some other small classes, but most of my students are private students. And this is the historical model of the work, that you come see your teacher, you know, like going to a piano lesson.
Sure.
For 40 to 45 minutes. And, you know, some teachers teach 30 minute lessons, some teach an hour, but you spend the time learning about the self-talk and going through everyday activities, things that we do very automatically, activities that are totally stereotyped, like getting in and out of a chair, which you probably do 100 times a day, never thinking about how it's accomplished or if it's efficient. Things like bending over, reaching, lifting, walking, and lying down, getting up and down off the ground. So these sort of everyday activities, because most people, they may pay some attention to form, maybe while they're working out. There's some, hopefully, some thought in that direction.
Yeah, sure.
Although I think for a lot of people, exercise is an opportunity to practice their bad habits harder. Yeah,
absolutely. I couldn't agree with you on more on that.
But nobody pays attention to, say, how they're opening the refrigerator, how they're unloading the dishwasher, how they're lifting their child. And that's the stuff that makes up most of our lives. And if we have all these bad habits of doing these things poorly, it's no wonder that we start to hurt. So we look at the basic everyday stuff first. And then we start to look at people's specialized activities. So a violinist may come in and play the violin. We'll look at, how are you using yourself in that activity? I've had people knit and do yoga and do calisthenics and give speeches. And we look at whatever it is that is in that person's life that they want to do better. Alexander technique is kind of it's the technique that underlies other techniques. So it doesn't necessarily replace anything else that you love to do in your life, but it helps you do it better. Mm-hmm. It helps you start from a place of freedom, poise, ease, all those words I heard when I was 15, so that you're in a place where you can actually learn and excel, as opposed to wondering, why can't I stand up straight? Or why does my back hurt?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's such an important message. I mean, I know I try to convey that a lot in my own work, that, health, it's really not about, the bikini ready body, the six pack mm-hmm. abs, the tight butt. It's really about the platform from which you're going to launch the rest of your life off of. And yes. So I love that, just sort of making that comparison to what you just said, that mm-hmm. that absolutely Alexander technique is sort of, the foundation of you going into all of your other passions and pursuits from a much more stable place.
Yes.
And yeah. That's awesome. Love that. Very clear. So give listeners three tips that they could start implementing right away.
Yes.
That would help them establish some healthier and better movement habits.
Mm-hmm. So this is sort of, it's a little three-step process, and you could do the steps independently
okay. Or
hopefully all together. And I'm going to sort of talk through it at a little more length, and then I'll just say it fast because it's the sort of thing that doesn't have to take long.
Okay.
So the first thing to do is stop.
Surprisingly, that.
Yeah. So actually taking a moment to cease activity and saying to yourself, no. A lot of people resist saying no to themselves because that sounds negative. That sounds icky. The no is about, no, I don't have to behave in the stereotyped way. I have a choice about how I proceed. And no, I don't have to do it the old way. So you can just stop and think no to yourself. Or if you can't stop because you're in the middle of a race, say, or something like that, you can still think no. And there's some amount of stopping that is happening neurologically. So that's the first thing and the most important. Just stop. The second thing is letting the breath out. We look at breathing as a fundamental aspect of coordination in the Alexander technique. In fact, in his early days, Alexander was known as that breathing chap. And people used to go to him for lessons on how to breathe better. And that's never really gone away. And one of the things that we see almost universally is that people tend to hold their breath or breathe very shallowly. Mm-hmm. And, they breathe enough to survive and not pass out, but not enough to really be functioning optimally.
Well, I notice in my own life, if I'm really stressed out, I have a hard time taking a deep breath. I mean, it's literally like, that's almost one of my red flags that I'm too stressed mm-hmm. because I literally can't take a deep enough breath.
Well, that's perfect. Actually, I'm going to speak to you directly.
Okay, go ahead. Sure.
Because I would suggest in that situation, don't try to take a deep breath.
Okay.
What I would suggest in that and every other situation is that you let your breath out.
Mm, okay.
So one easy way to do that, I mean, you could just let it out anyway, but sometimes having just a little bit of oomph with it is helpful. So imagine a little feather is floating by your mouth and you just blow away the feather. Okay. And when you blow the breath out or you let the breath out, then you're allowing space for air to come in.
I can. Mm-hmm.
Because when we just tell ourselves sort of arbitrarily, take a deep breath, what usually happens is there's already a lot of air in the lungs. Mm-hmm. And so there's not a lot of space. And then we're sort of perpetuating a cycle where there's not a lot of space for air. And then we feel like we can't breathe. So we always in our work suggest that people let the breath out to let it come back in. In fact, we basically never tell anyone, take a breath. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, that's part of it. Mm-hmm. You let the breath out so you can let it come back in. And I do that a few times. Okay. Well, now I'm in a better respiratory cycle, a little more coordinated.
It's almost going back to that subtraction thing we talked about at the beginning of the episode, right? Subtracting before you add. Yeah. I love that.
I love that. That's a, thank you for making that connection that I hadn't made. I sometimes tell people in this incredibly simplistic way, but it's silly. If you have a bowl of dirty water and you want a bowl of clean water, what's the first thing you have to do?
Empty the bowl.
Empty the bowl. So that's what,
Love it.
So that's the second thing. So we stop, we blow a feather, maybe a couple times. And then here's some of the thinking stuff that we had mentioned. So a little background. Most people, if they want to be more upright, we have ideas about how to do that. And it usually involves things like engage your core and push your head up and push your shoulders back and down. And now I'm quite upright and you can hear what it's doing to my voice. Again, perhaps it's not the most efficient or functional way to be upright.
It's forceful.
Mm-hmm. It's forceful. Yeah, it's hard. And then people wonder why they can't keep it up for more than a few seconds. And then they just go back to their collapse, their habitual collapse or slump. Well, basically because they're doing it wrong. And it's no one's fault because we're in a society where we're taught that you just have to try harder if things aren't working for you. You just have to do more.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to propose a different way of coming upright. And I'm going to call it lighten up. And I didn't make this up. It's actually, well, of course, it's Alexander technique, but specifically some researchers at Oregon Health and Science University did a study where they compared these two ways of thinking and how upright people became. So they actually did measurements. So with lighten up, instead, you're going to think, you're going to notice that you're pulling yourself down, which most of us are most of the time. We're engaging muscles that are actually shortening us. And you're going to give yourself permission to stop doing that. And you're going to let your head balance easily on the top of your spine. And you're going to allow the ribs and the shoulders to just open effortlessly. So you just think that to yourself. And I don't know about you, but I notice a change.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You look really, I can see you and you look quite upright, very poised. Not that you don't always. But it's an easier way of coming upright and a more actually natural way. Being upright is our sort of natural inheritance. We've evolved to be upright. Mm-hmm. So it shouldn't take a lot of effort, but it's all that extra stuff that we've been doing for years or decades that is pulling ourselves down. So the three things are stop, think no, blow a feather, and think lighten up.
I love that.
And it can be that fast. It can take, 5 seconds, 3 seconds. And I would say do it in the morning and do it at night before bed and do it during the day. And I really try to kind of walk my talk because I certainly do not have everything all together all the time. And I don't want to make it sound like, just do this and everything will be great. So I just kind of share a little story with you.
Please.
Last night, I had this great idea that the kids and I, they were going to make their own pizzas. We're going to make our own pizzas with my 3 2.5-year-olds. And they were playing outside. And they were wet. And I'm trying to transition them inside. I have all this stuff set up. And then we're potty training and someone peed himself. I mean, it was a shit show.
Yeah.
And, well, not literally. Nobody peed. But I was freaking out. I was getting really stressed and upset that why isn't this working? And it's so hard. And I was getting myself into this really excited and stressed state. And so it was a perfect opportunity to test what I was anticipating talking to you about. And so there I was in my kitchen going, no, lighten up, no, lighten up. And it was so interesting. I probably took about 10 seconds to go through that with myself. I kind of noticed the shift that was happening mentally. First, I'd been in this very, very stressed state and I was almost in tears. And the first thing that happened was the kind of urgency and anger and frustration piece receded. And I just felt a little sad. I felt a little sad that this wasn't going smoothly. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that's okay. it's okay to be sad. The purpose of learning to stop is not to be happy and feel great all the time. It's just to stop hurting myself, to stop making things worse. And then it struck me as kind of funny because it's ridiculous and it's funny. And then I was ready to proceed, and we did. And all of that happened in about 10 seconds because I managed to force myself to stop. And it's in those situations where it's so hard to stop.
Loving this podcast? A new episode of the Grace and Grit podcast will launch every Saturday. Please head on over to iTunes and leave a review so the Grace and Grit message can spread to more women who need to hear it.
And I think, you know, the older I get and the more complicated life gets and the more I deal with my own stress patterns, the more I've come to respect that motion needs to be moved. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing by staying so high-paced and ramped up and sort of refusing to address what's really going on, not stopping, is mm-hmm. we're not letting emotion move. We're not recognizing it for what it is. But if we can just pause and, like you said, just say, you know, I'm feeling a little sad because this really isn't turning out the way I hoped. Mm-hmm. It passes so much faster.
Yes.
I just kept forcing and fighting, and that would have just not ended well. I know. I can see it now. And I really, really appreciate this because so often I encourage my clients so much. We talk about this at length about pausing and stalling and delaying. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even if they're going to make a choice that they know probably isn't in the best interest of their health, at least putting that off for even a minute, you know, or mm-hmm. 5 minutes, just to give themselves some space to really consider what's truly going on in that moment. And this is so perfect because I think something so tangible, so doable, and so simplistic is really just what they need, you know, to be able to sort of get themselves into a different perspective and a different headspace, because that's really what this is. It's a mindset shift.
Yes. And it's giving yourself a choice. Mm. If you give yourself time, then you give yourself a choice. And you could choose to do things the old way, but it's a choice.
Yes.
The way that we typically operate, we have almost no choice.
Correct.
We will do the old thing. It's inevitable. It's a train that once it's out of the station, you can't get off it.
Mm-hmm. And to me, that is what radical responsibility is considering your choices, right? And making mm-hmm. the one that is most in line with who you say you really want to be in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's so easy to beat ourselves up when we screw up, because we screw up all the time.
All the time.
But you can always stop. You know, you can stop in the next moment and the next one and the next one.
Yeah. And which is, I think, a really interesting, I think I saw a video on this somewhere. Who's the woman who started Spanx? What's her name?
Oh, I can't remember.
Okay. Well, her. Yeah. Her name's not going to mind right now.
Maybe? I don't know.
But I saw this video where her dad, you know, really prompted her as a child. He asked her every day what she was failing at. You know, as almost a positive inquiry, like if you're not failing at something, you're probably not living bold enough and you're probably not living with any kind of, you know, vigor and curiosity. Mm-hmm. So you should be failing often, but it's how we handle the failures that, you know, mm-hmm. that obviously is very defining of how our life's going to turn out. Mm-hmm. And I see this a lot in parenting with my own kid. And I'm sure you do too, is my son, he's very competitive, very mm-hmm. hard on himself.
And sounds like someone I know.
I knew you were going to say that. So it's one of the things I've really started to tap into with him is every day at the dinner table, we all talk about what we failed at and we talk about mm-hmm. it in a lighthearted way
mm-hmm.
and encourage each other. Like, that's great. You failed at that. That means that you tried something new, or, you know, just trying to get him to shift the idea of failure.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do, and of course, with women's health, this is such a hot topic, because 99% of what's really going on with most women is their lack of self-compassion for what it takes to create change.
Mm-hmm.
They want to be perfect.
It starts with childhood. It starts with people mm-hmm. being afraid to fail, and so only sticking to things that they're good at, and then they get to be adults, and is it any surprise that they expect to only do things that they're good at? Well, life isn't like that.
No. And I will say too, that good friends make a big difference too, because you have been one of those friends in my life that is just always, you know, we've been through the highs and lows together for sure. And I adore you. And I'm so happy that you're here today and that you were able to kind of just get this message out, which is such an important one. And I learned a lot. I know listeners will walk away with a lot from today. A question that I ask all of my guests, and I definitely want your intake, is how the qualities of grace and grit have empowered your own path.
Yeah, that's, I've thought about that because I really enjoy when you ask people that. And I had a couple different thoughts on it. Although I do want to say that I adore you too.
And I know you must because you've kept me around for 30 years.
So. Yeah. It's been such an honor to be on your show. I do. I love it.
Oh, I'm so glad.
I love your podcast and the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
So in a purely Alexander Technique perspective, I think that grace is the moment of stopping. Mm. It's giving ourselves time. And grit is actually doing it, like actually stopping, because it's really easy to talk about that and it sounds really nice, but in the moment, it's so hard to stop. It takes some grit to kind of make ourselves do it. But then in my life sort of as a whole, I was thinking about that sort of convoluted story that I told you at the beginning about how I came to this work, and I enjoy looking back over the path. You know, we can look back at our lives and say, wow, how unexpected that led to this and this led to that. And I met that person and we can see it all laid out like a map, sort of a circuitous map. And that's grace. It's grace that all that stuff happened to us, even the really horrible things, because it always led to the next thing. Mm-hmm. But we can't see it when we're in it.
No.
So the grit is sort of a little bit of faith that we just keep going, knowing that that's the case, that there's grace operating in our lives, even when it feels like a slog, even when it's really hard.
Oh, that's so beautiful, Eve. Very well said. So how can people find out more about you and your work? I know I want to direct people to your website and just more. Yeah.
So my website is inbalanceat.com. And I realized after I chose that name that it sounds a little bit like imbalance with an M, but it's actually imbalance with an N.
Imbalance, yeah.
Like no.
Yes.
And I like to blog. I really like to write. I've always liked to write, and I found an outlet for it. So there's a lot of stuff on that site. A lot of my musings about how this work has been a part of my life with regard to all kinds of things, from parenting to you know, dropping an egg on the floor and pretty much everything in between. So that's a good way to start.
Excellent. And for those of you listening, I will leave Eve's, the link to her website at the bottom of the page that this podcast is hosted on my own website. So I can't thank you enough for taking the time. I know how insanely busy you are, but I'm glad you could also take a time out, you know?
Yes. It's sort of, it's like, oh, I can leave this all behind. I am recording a podcast.
Exactly. I love that.
So it's been wonderful. Thank you.
Yes, definitely. And I'm sure I will have you back again in the future. So I hope you have a wonderful day, and we will be connecting soon, no doubt.
Yes. Thank you, Courtney.
For those of you listening in, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to be here with us today. I sure hope that it was helpful and insightful. I love hearing from you, Courtney@graceandgrit.com. And two quick reminders, the 7-day Grace and Grit Challenge is coming up very soon, within a few days. The 28th, I believe, is our start date. So make sure you head on over to the website, graceandgrit.com, and get yourself registered so I can get you information to sign up for that. And secondly, just to keep in mind that this new program that I'm running called Bit by Bit with Grace and Grit, which is all about thriving through the holiday season this year, is also starting mid-November. So if that's something that you think you would be fired up about and wanting to participate in, I would also encourage you to get signed up at the website for that. Just leave your name and your email, and you'll get some reminders about exactly how to participate in those events. So again, thank you so much. I hope you have a fabulous day, and I hope you'll join me again next week. Thank you for listening to the Grace and Grit podcast. It is time to mend the fabric of the female health story, and it starts with you taking radical responsibility for your own self-care. You are worth the effort, and with a little grace and grit, anything is possible.